Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. Welcome back.
Thank you. And well, we should either welcome each other back, or neither of us welcomes each other back, because
okay,
it's both of our podcasts. It's our audio home, which we cohabitate. So we don't need to welcome each other.
That's how rumors get started.
enjoying the spring finally reaching here in Ontario?
Yeah, well, today was actually, I didn't need my winter coat. So, you know, yes, it must be spring, which means we'll get 3 days of this and then it'll be summer and hot and terrible.
Or we'll get 2 days of this and then it'll be rain and then -2 at night. And then it's become kind of cliche to say that we don't get spring in Ontario, but the fact is we don't get spring in Ontario.
No.
We get pieces of weather. Like it's erratic. You can't plan on it. I still have my winter tires on the car.
I know, just enough to give you hope is what it is. You know, in fact, my wife has a policy of getting, you know, we have a little flower arrangement that sits in a pot out front of our front door. And she said, yeah, I'm feeling, you know, we had that nice weather early on last month. And she said, I'm feeling good about this spring, so I'm going to get some. And I'm like, we still could get snow. She said, no, I got a good feeling about this. Well, those flowers have been moved in and out of the house because of frost warnings. They got more miles on them than my car at the moment.
Well, in pandemic times, that doesn't say a lot.
No.
I had to fill my tank up the other day. And I was like, when was the last time I did this?
Yeah, no, I'm exactly the same way. Out of sheer boredom, I got new tires on the car because, you know, it was an outing. It was something to do. And I had a coupon. So it's like, sure, it's a half day's worth of excitement. That's what passes for excitement these days. And yeah. Now I got nowhere to go in the car. So it's
what's the term I'm thinking for? The expectations are quite low at this point.
Oh, they're so
entertainment.
Low.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is why they're listening to us.
well, hopefully they are.
Speaking of listening to, during this pandemic, those of us who are responsible have done our best to listen to the medical authorities that have told us what behaviors to engage in, which to refrain from, what measures to take. And sometimes that has changed as more knowledge of the virus becomes known.
Yeah, like the masking. I mean, you know, early on, no one really knew if the masking was that big a deal. And, you know, we suspected hand washing was important, but the whole idea of fomites, particulate in the air, and there's still questions about whether or not you can catch it walking past someone. It seems to be no, but, there's been a lot of uncertainty, but a lot of it has been sort of really low hassle. I mean, it's like, it's not a big deal to wear a mask. I mean, some people think it's, you know, the end of their freedom as we know it and all the rest, but, you know, and it's a little piece of cloth over your face. It's not a big deal to wear a mask. Washing your hands, you ought to be doing that anyway, whether there's a pandemic or not. It's just a good idea to wash your hands.
It struck me, Stephen, how many people, it was a revelation, this idea to wash their hands regularly.
Well, they're finding, like, you know, they haven't had a cold or the flu or anything else. I mean, all of those sort of common diseases, it just went through the floor because people are washing their hands. They go, hey, wait a second, I don't have to be sick. Washing is this wonderful revelation that they've had that it actually prevents disease.
It would have stopped the bubonic plague.
Well, yeah, it probably would have, you know, but these are low aggravation things that, you know, if you do them, it turns out not to be right, or, you know, the science changes, you know, it's not a big deal. I wore a mask for a bit. Sure, it's no fun carrying one around, but, you know, it doesn't change my life particularly.
I found in the winter they were very nice in keeping my face.
Oh, yeah, they were toasty. I'm thinking about wearing them all the time.
As far as I'm concerned, that's part of my winter gear from now on. but now we've got, We were told that the vaccines which were approved, the Pfizer, AstraZeneca, were safe and were being distributed and being administered to people. And now we're hearing that AstraZeneca is being halted because, I don't know if this is an accurate figure, but something like 8 people out of 850,000 got blood clots.
Yes, it's either 6 or 8, but yeah, it's in the single digits.
Yeah, and which is you know, we're talking about this whole time we're trumpeting science, believe in the science. But well, if you believe in the science, 8 people out of 850,000 is a percentage of a percentage of a percentage. It is not statistically relevant. And the fact that we're letting anecdotal stories determine what vaccine people are getting, this boggles my mind. This is coming from the people who've been telling us to believe in the science, and I believe in science, and 8 out of 850,000 is not, it's not significant.
You know, and we talked, you know, we talked a few podcasts back about the expectation that people have right now that they can live a risk-free life. You know, even in times of crisis and pandemic and civil unrest and all the rest, they think they can live a risk-free life, and life has a lot of risks. You know, people take stupid risks all the time. I mean, the people who fall off of high-rise flagpoles taking selfies and doing, you know, stunts, you know, for YouTube.
Oh, you mean Darwinism?
Yeah, you know, kind of, you know, clearing out that end of the gene pool. But, you know, aside from those sort of risks that people willingly undertake, in all other aspects of their lives, they expect everything that, you know, is important that we do to be completely risk-free. I mean, and vaccines are one of those sorts of things. And, you know, it's tragic that anybody dies from anything, especially, you know, a vaccine. But, you know, vaccines, you know, that we have for common childhood illnesses carry with them risks. I mean, they're not the risks that most people think about. You know, it's not the autism risk that, you know, has been debunked over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, you know, there are allergy risks, and there, you know, people, you know, 1 in a million will have a bad reaction to it. And, you know, and it's incredibly sad when it happens and tragic. And you know, and you hope it isn't you or one of your loved ones. But the greater good is that the million other people are now safe from a terrible, debilitating disease that would spread through society. And, you know, to see that there are, you know, a handful of cases of people who've had bad reactions, you know, these specialized kinds of blood clots as a result of, they think, caused by AstraZeneca. There's an article today about the economics of it saying, you know, it's still a pretty good deal for humanity because those are acceptable losses. Because, you know, life has risks and it's sad and all the rest, but the greater good, especially an overwhelmingly greater good, you know, really demands that we use every tool in our toolbox to beat the pandemic. But now they're saying, you know, but you know, that is different now than when we had tons of AstraZeneca. Now we're getting more Moderna, more Pfizer. And what they're now saying is, you know what? The risks are slightly higher than we thought for AstraZeneca, but we now have these alternatives that have much lower risks. So why take the risk at all? Why don't we take this other stuff, assuming that we don't find that there are side effects and other mortalities related to the other vaccines?
Well, I mean, have they authoritatively ruled out any comorbidities with these deaths, with these blood clots?
They haven't reported that as far as I can see.
I couldn't find anything like that either. Because first of all, with biodiversity, not everybody is going to have the same reaction to something being introduced to their system. And some stuff will be very idiosyncratic to a small number of people. But do we stop it for the larger number of people? Because a very, very small number of people may get ill from it. I understand if you're susceptible to blood clots, I understand the concern. I got AstraZeneca. I am fine. I am totally fine to get the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the same. And, you know, they're going like, oh, you're being heartless about people who, could have, a morbidity as a result of their AstraZeneca. I took it knowing what the risks were, and I assumed they could be higher, they could be lower. I'm also not someone who buys lottery tickets particularly, but I will accept those odds And you know what? I would take the second one as well. And they're finding too, you know, the science seems to be that if you were okay for your first dose, you're going to be fine for the second dose, because it's, you know, if it didn't trigger it the first time, it's really, really, really unlikely that getting AstraZeneca the second time is going to give you that blood clot that everyone's worried about. So I don't understand why they're, you know, and they may change. I mean, I expect that there will be something saying, you know what, if you got your first AstraZeneca vaccination and you want to sign a big fat waiver, you know, we will give you the second one, because I think the science is there that says you'll be absolutely fine. And otherwise it just sits there in freezers going bad.
Yeah, that's the thing. We you know, talk about shortages and so on. You know, some places say there's shortages of vaccine, other places, other vaccine centers are empty. I mean, this whole thing has been darkly laughable as so far as the rollout. I mean, I thank God that we never went into combat, full-scale combat with General Hillier leading the charges, because people would be deployed all over the place and not in the actual zones where there's war. He did not prove to be the asset that I initially thought. Well, brilliant idea, general, they're organized, they understand campaigns, I understand. No, it did not work out. And, you know, you use the term acceptable losses, and you say that, and people say, would you consider it acceptable loss if it was you or someone you loved? And it's like, well, I probably wouldn't, because I'm too emotional to think logically, to think big picture. But if you think big picture, there are certain things such as acceptable losses for the greater good. It happens. And sure, it can sound heartless, especially, you know, I think that if there were 800 cases of blood clots, it would hit people less than eight, because yeah. 800 starts to become a number that is vague in their head. It's, you know, numbers start to become too big to grasp. But eight is something that is nice and tidy, and you can relate to eight people. You can, you know, it doesn't, it's a number that doesn't become amorphous at any point in time. So the fact that it's so small, I think, is the reason that people are being hit emotionally with it.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look at sort of the world's biggest experiment in it, and that's England, the UK, where, you know, AstraZeneca was, it's the Oxford vaccine. It was developed there. And so, you know, it was rolled out, and they've had, I think the number is 21.2 million first doses of AstraZeneca have been given in Britain's rollout. And they have had 168 blood clots. I don't know. I'm trying to see if I can see where, how many people actually, I think 30 and 32 deaths of it. Right. And that number, the number went up. And that, you never know if that's because of better reporting or whatever else, or, you know, it's, but, you know, the blood clots are supposed to happen fairly quickly after getting the shot, you know, within the first couple of days. So, you know, it's not like you're waiting around for people who got it months ago to develop these things. If you got through your first week or so, then you're not going to get it. But again, 168 with 32 deaths in 21.2 million first doses. And the result is the UK is opening up. I mean, they recorded no deaths the other day for the first time in a long, long time from COVID. And, you know, they're getting back to life. I've spoken to some of my friends in England, and they're looking forward to dining indoors and all those normal things. So AstraZeneca worked in the UK. You know, it's terrible if you're one of those 32 people. And as you said, you know, people say, well, you're heartless. But you and I both rolled the dice on it. Okay. You know, I'm no spring chicken, which is how I got the AstraZeneca. You know, I qualified yeah. not because yeah, I'm not a frontline worker or anything like that. I got it because I'm old, yeah. And you know, and a higher risk factor. But I rolled up my sleeve and took my chances along with everybody else, and it turned out fine for me. Might not have been, in which case you'd be getting a new podcast partner. But you know, these are the risks that you take at times like these.
Yeah, I think when the history of this time is written and we're able to stand back and look at it with you know, fresh eyes or with a grander vista, we're going to see how like we were chickens with their head cut off in many ways. There was so much running around from pillar to post, so much confusion, so much disinformation, so much misinformation. It's amazing that we're getting as far as we are in fighting this virus, because it's really been helter skelter. There's been no real smooth rollout of information that has stuck, that has been consistent. There's been openings and closings and openings again, and then closings again. Businesses, you know, ready to open, like places, restaurants ready to open because they're told they can open. They buy meat and then they're told they have to stay closed and the meat goes bad. There's a bit of madness to all this. And I think that part of the madness is worrying about eight people in 850,000.
Yeah. And, you know, part of the problem has been is as a society, we've lost the ability to mobilize ourselves for tasks. I mean, you know, and you know, fortunately, you don't have to mobilize yourself for too many emergencies over the course of your lifetime. And, you know, that would be pretty terrible if you had to. You know, we're
especially
blessed
if we had to, because we're not really great at that.
No, I mean, we have in the past, you know, people point back to, you know, World War II and things like that, but that was a long, long time ago. And since then, you know, people have become a little bit more selfish, and governments have become, you know, we've had 40 years of sort of decentralizing government. Even as it gets bigger, it gets less competent at doing things, especially the ones that deliver services directly to you, you know, provincial and city governments. You know, to get people to all start pulling in the same direction is really, really tough, especially in the age of internet, where everyone has an opinion, everyone has read a Facebook page, everyone is worried about what Gwyneth Paltrow is recommending. It's, you know, we fragmented so much. So you get someone like General Hillier, who is there to mobilize society and put this, you know, with military precision to get a rollout plan for getting needles in arms. And at the end of the day, there's no infrastructure for it, and there's no real political will for it, because it does require people to move in lockstep. And I'm not a big believer in, you know, doing anything without question, but there's a point where you just go like, you know, we've got to do this, people. And I don't care that, you know, you read that, you know, your yoga instructor said that that the Pfizer vaccine has got gluten in it or whatever. Roll up your arm and do it, because it's good for society. You know, everyone wants to know, well, what's in it for me? Well, you know, you're part of society, and what's in it for you is living in a good society where people aren't dropping dead and coughing on you and making life impossible. And the same with the lockdowns. You know, everyone was like, well, you know, the economic devastation to my small business is real, and it is real. But, you know, what do you want to do about that? I mean, it's going to be tough. Some businesses are not going to survive. People are going to have hardship. The government, you know, thankfully we have a government in federal power, which believes in spending money to make people's lives easier during times of crisis, as opposed to, you know, our provincial conservative governments that seem to not believe in that at all. But, you know, you can cushion that blow, but people are going to suffer, and we're not really good at suffering because we haven't had to do it for so long. And, you know, people will defy, you know, public health laws. I mean, they've had to padlock, you know, there was the barbecue that restaurant in Toronto. There are churches in Alberta that defy the provincial lockdowns. And what do you do with people like that who believe that their inconvenience outweighs the public good?
That's the question. And the answer is you create powerful disincentives or punishments for them. Because, and now you're going to get complaints of heavy-handed government and jackboots and all the other nonsense that they bring up, the parallels to Nazi Germany, without recognizing that there's no parallel to Nazi Germany in any of this. But it's internet shorthand that people use. And you're going to get people saying that if you enforce these laws. But at the same time, you can't worry about being popular. It's like, you know, your mom or your dad shouldn't be your best friend. They should be your parent. And in this case, yeah, the government has to act like the adult in the room. And because so many of us are acting like children, very selfish. We've seen the world more and more become customized to our own experience. We can choose what programming we watch, where, when, on what device. We can curate whatever music we want, so we don't have to hear other stuff we don't like. We can read certain news and information and avoid the stuff that challenges us. We've been lulled into this electronic womb that where the only thing that matters is satisfying our individual desires. And now we're being asked to do something that flies in the face of decades of progress towards, and I don't use progress in the sense of good, but decades of incremental progress towards this promoting a tremendous selfishness. And people, you know, a lot of people are responding well to it. I mean, last time I saw somebody near me who wasn't wearing a mask was probably about 2 months ago at a grocery store. And other than that, in the last year, I haven't seen people not wearing masks. Maybe it's just where I am. They're just more caring about the community, or they're more compliant. I don't know. You know, we can't lose track of the fact that so many Canadians have taken this seriously and have made some, you know, I can't even call it a sacrifice when it comes to wearing a mask. It made some minor, you know, minor inconveniences to their life in order to try to be part of the societal concerted effort to get this virus, you know, under control. But it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. And there's been a lot of squeaky wheels and a lot of grease during this whole period. I think we're, you know, as the warm weather gets here, I think that there's going to be a lot more people willing to defy the stay-at-home order, because, you know, the police in Toronto busted a party with 150 people last weekend, none of them wearing masks. That's going to get attention. But you have 10 people over to your house in your backyard for a barbecue, the cops aren't going to see you. They're not going to bust you. You have 15 people over. Not going to, I mean, your neighbors may call you in, but they're not going to come, you know, looking over fences into backyards to see how many people are at your barbecue. And I think people are going to start saying, you know what, I've been good about this for so long. We've all had our shots that are, you know, everyone that's coming has had their shots, and we're willing to mitigate the risk and have social contact again. Now that the sun is out and people want to get out from inside the four walls that have been closing in on them. So I don't know how much longer these stay-at-home orders can really be properly enforced or are going to be followed.
Well, and the difficulty has been that a lot of, you know, a number of the provinces, you know, Ontario and Alberta particularly, have not wanted to be unpopular with, you know, both their core you know, voting groups, core supporters, and, you know, with the sort of the disgruntled population as a whole, mm-hmm. by making the tough choices, by doing the hard lockdown, by doing the enforcement, by, you know, handing out the tickets, and getting, you know, getting serious about what needed to be done early on about containing the virus, about keeping the numbers down. And partially, you know, I think both the Kenny and the Ford governments are governments of amateurs. I mean, a lot of them really have no business being in government. I mean, they were electable, but they really don't have the skills to handle, you know, they could handle government in a good, prosperous period, but in a tough economic period and a pandemic crisis like we're in right now, they just don't have what it takes to make the tough decisions and disappoint people and risk unpopularity by doing, you know, the hard, sharp things that would really curtail the spread of the virus. Instead, they've gone for half measures. They've ignored the data. They've left the schools open way too long because, you know, first they said, well, the kids aren't a big vector. And it turns out they really are a big vector, not necessarily for themselves, but for their families and for other families. You know, they pass it around, mm-hmm. even if they're not getting sick. But they wouldn't take the hard choice, which is, you know what, we got to close down the schools for, you know, like really close them down for a couple of weeks, close everything down so there isn't this community spread. And instead, like a bunch of five-year-olds, they're looking for scapegoats. And, you know, we talked last time about blaming the foreigners. And yeah. You know, it's like, oh, you know, Ford is like, well, it's all those international flights. It's the federal government that isn't, we would be just fine if it wasn't for all these aircraft coming in.
Yeah, when, aircraft basically full of Canadians coming from foreign destinations. They're not Canadians. Foreigners. They're Canadians from foreign destinations. And you can't tell a Canadian you can't come home.
No. And in fact, you know, we test them before they get on the plane. We quarantine them and test them several times after they get home. Now, the nature of the virus is tests can give you false negatives and the virus can show up later. So there are people who do show up with COVID. And hopefully we catch most of them by quarantine, you know, and again, the province is responsible for enforcing quarantine, but they don't have the manpower or the interest in actually calling people up and, you know, making sure, you know, doing house visits because small government, it's money. I'm not going to pay people to go and check people in quarantine. So people break quarantine. But the problem is the provincial government isn't enforcing the quarantines. And it turns out that 60% of the flights linked to COVID infections just this past month in April came from domestic travel. They didn't come from international travel. They're flights from Edmonton and Calgary and Winnipeg and all those other places. And Ontario's own data shows travel is an insignificant source of infection compared to all the others. It's a handful of cases that come in. It's not, you know, but, you know, to say, oh, you know, it's, you know, close down those airports, that's not where the spread is coming from. It's coming from the Amazon warehouses and Canada Post and from the construction industry and from schools. You know, it's coming from all of those sorts of sources. And those are all things that the province doesn't want to do anything about because it's unpopular, because they've got, you know, in the construction industry, they've got a lot of their donors are part of that group. The Ontario Proud people who, you know, was actually, as they said, it was five construction companies in a trench coat pretending to be a grassroots organization. And all, you know, these other big things that we're now getting a little serious about, because public health, actually, it isn't even the province that's getting serious about it. The municipalities have said, we've had enough of this. We're going to use our municipal public health authority to go in and shut down shifts at Amazon and you know, these other stores there where there's been more than five cases. We're going to shut it down ourselves because the province isn't acting. But it's much easier to say, you know what, we should be closing the airports. Like, we have had travel restrictions since March of 2020 on international travel. And it has only been, like you said, Canadians coming back, a few essential workers, and you know, truck drivers. And they say, well, the borders, people are going around flying in by flying to Buffalo and then walking across the Peace Bridge. And they forget that the province was offered, you know, Trudeau last week told Ford, look, you got a problem with that. You've got the authority to set up a tent on the other side of the Peace Bridge and enforce quarantine and test people and do whatever you like. You can look after your side of the border because that is Ontario and you've got the public health authority to do it. And Ford said, no, I'm not doing that. But he's still blaming the air travelers coming in and people sneaking in and coughing all over everybody. And that just isn't the case. It's like 1.6% of the cases in Canada are from travel.
Yeah, it's, you know, when you hear these stats, you realize that the situation is not as being described by the government, because you hear there's flights coming in from other countries. You know, your common sense detector says, yeah, they're the ones bringing it in. And you know your bias, your xenophobic bias that everybody has to some degree, kicks in, and you it's one of those gut feelings. Seems right, but you look at the actual stats and no, it's not right. You know, and you know the government wanted to keep the schools open because the businesses wanted their employees going to work, and they couldn't go to work when they were providing care for their kids at home. Right. It hurt the economy, and so. It's transparent where who supplies the big funding for Doug Ford, for Jason Kenney. It's really clear by who he's accepted from closures and who he hasn't and the decisions that they've made. But I think that where a lot of people are at fatigue point or past fatigue point, and I think some of them are going to start basically in their minds reducing the actual level of threat so that they feel comfortable going out. So they're going to tell themselves that they don't really believe the threat is as high or the risk is as high because they want to feel good about getting out of the house, and they really want to get out of the house.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who among us doesn't want to get out of the house and do normal things again?
Yeah.
Assuming we remember how to do them.
Yeah, whatever they were.
Yeah. But, you know, especially Ontario's response, and I suspect it's the same in Alberta as well. I mean, the response is sort of like the person who gets a cold and you go, you know what, you should go to bed and drink some hot soup and sleep for a day or two and you'll feel much better. And they go, no, I can't afford to do that. I'm going to go to work and I'm going to, I've got a road trip I got to take and all the rest. And they turn a 2-day cold into 2 weeks because they don't look after themselves. And that's been basically what's happened to Ontario. We could have really reduced our numbers by serious lockdowns. That would have been short-term painful, but long-term the benefits would have been so great to us, but there wasn't any political will to do that. And now, like you said, the average person is tired of these half measures that have dragged on, have a little bit better, you buy the meat, put it in the freezer thinking you're going to do taste of the Danforth, and then you're in lockdown a few days later because it didn't work because everyone decided, they were sick of it too. So you just have this series of half measures that has never solved the problem and never got us out of this. I mean, people say, well, look at New Zealand, those guys, they really have it together. So yeah, but they had serious, serious lockdowns. Like nobody does anything for weeks and we are going to stomp on this thing. The Atlantic provinces were similar to this. I mean, they had really good records, until recently, where they actually shut things down and included travel, included everything. We're going to do this for a couple of weeks, get it under control, and then we will be able to reopen because we're not spreading it to each other over those 2 weeks, and the virus will not have hosts to multiply through. But again, there just wasn't the political will to do that here. Instead, we did a whole bunch of half measures that have just kept us sniffling for 12, 14 months now.
Yeah. Well, I'm reaching fatigue about talking about this.
Well, yeah, you and I talk about what we're going to talk about every time we do one of these podcasts. And you go, COVID, do we really want to talk about COVID again? But it's the gift that just keeps on giving because, you can't get away from it. And there always seems to be some new screw up that is, that's throwing a curve at us just when we think, great, the summer's coming, we'll be able to enjoy it. Maybe not.
Well, why don't we switch to another topic that's completely different. And now for something sure. completely different, something we were going to talk about last week, but let's get to it this week, which is what's going on with our Canadian military?
Holy cow. Yeah, it's the saga, it started, it didn't start with Vance, but in the current iteration, it started with General Vance, the Chief of the Defense Staff. And it's such a long tail that has so much spin on it. Basically, he was appointed Chief of the Defense Staff by Harper in, I think it was June or July of 2015. So the 2015 federal election was on the horizon, and he was promoted, but apparently he had he had a past. There were things that were going on in his past as a senior military officer. There was a relationship with another woman who was a Major Kelly Brennan, who's come forward, an infantry officer, and she says that she'd been in a sexual relationship with Vance since 2001, when he was a battalion commander at CFB Gagetown in New Brunswick. And relationships between the ranks, especially when there's a disparity in the ranks, especially if they are someone in a position of power and authority over you in the military, is an absolute no-no. Except, with the whistleblowers, the women who've come forward have said, it's a nod and a wink and it happens, and what happens on deployment and maneuvers stays on maneuvers. And apparently there's all kinds of harassment and sexual shenanigans, consensual and otherwise, that go on in the Canadian Armed Forces. And this is part of the culture, and that we've had several inquiries and commissions into this, and they've all found the same thing, that there is not just sexual harassment, but sexual exploitation. There is, consensual and non-consensual. There is discrimination on the basis of gender. There's discrimination on the basis of sexual preference. And the military has this problem. But Vance, with Major Brennan, fathered two children, allegedly. She alleges that they have two children together, which sounds like a bit of a relationship. There's something about the story that I'm an old family lawyer. I used to do divorce lives, do custody and access cases and all that kind of stuff, and it's no more than a spidey sense, but there's something odd about the story. And this isn't laying blame anywhere. There certainly is an inequality there, but a long-term relationship that results in two children. Yes, you could get, you can get pregnant on your first try, as too many people find out, but, to have two children in a long-term relationship, who knows what goes on beyond closed doors. And it's, I never try to understand other people's relationships, but there's something about that relationship that is odd. But at the same time, there were other complaints against Vance. Then in 2012, he apparently sent an email to someone, a soldier he significantly outranked, it says, inviting her to join him on a vacation to a nudist resort. Yeah, and he was a major general at the time, and the soldier was a corporal. You can't get too much farther apart in terms of power structure than major general to corporal. And it's that email was turned over to the Canadian Forces as an ombudsman, Gary Walburn, and that was turned over. And it was when he was already chief of the defense staff, and Trudeau was prime minister at this point. And there was another thing where Vance's current marriage began as a relationship with a subordinate as well, but she was a U.S. his now wife is a U.S. was a U.S. officer when he met her at NATO, where he served as deputy commander from 2013 to 2014. So there are all these things, and some of the people, unfortunately, and this is where the Conservatives tried to make hay of it, wouldn't allow themselves to be identified. They wouldn't make a formal complaint. They complained, but then they said, no, I don't want it to go any farther. And they didn't want it to go any farther for all kinds of good reasons, because there's no faith in the system that there'll be justice. One, I think it was Major Brennan, who said that Vance controls so much of the military that there's no way that she wouldn't be the one who's punished as a result. So it went to the ombudsman, who said, there's a problem with Vance. but I can't, you know, and it's vaguely, it's sort of what this is, but I can't get, I can't tell you who it is or what the exact nature of the problem is. And by the way, the person who made the complaint doesn't want it to be doesn't want there to be a formal investigation and doesn't want to be identified. And that was sort of what was thrown in Harjit Singh, the Minister of Defense's lap. And he said, well, what do you want me to do with that? Like, you know, complainant who is uncooperative and will not take the stand. Yeah, it's terrible, but
what can I do?
Yeah, how do I do something with this?
And there really isn't any way. You know, it's like the same happens often with Crown attorneys. Sometimes they won't bring charges because they know, look, this is not going to stick.
The complainant won't testify.
Yeah, the complainant won't testify. I've got nothing.
In the United States, say, well, they don't want to press charges. It's like, well, you know, okay, what can we do then?
Yeah, there is nothing that can be done in a situation like this. I mean, it's unfortunate that the Harper government didn't do a better, more vigorous background check on Vance before promoting him, because was he really super skilled at covering all of this up, or was it like Brendan said, a nudge and a wink? People just look the other way. I don't know, but it wasn't the liberals that promoted him. It was the conservatives. So for them to be belly aching now when they didn't do a proper job vetting the guy is kind of rich.
Yeah, and especially when you consider that O'Toole at the time was the Minister of Veterans Affairs. I mean, he wasn't DND, but he was in, as he likes to remind us every time he possibly can. Yes. He was a military guy, and this is he's interested in all things military and cherishes our military and all the rest. I mean, it's hard to believe that he wouldn't have had around the cabinet table some inkling of that at the time. And but we know the conservatives have no shame at all, and they will loudly accuse the other side of things that they have done themselves. And the conservatives have made a lot of mileage out of the ignorance of the general public of how the command structure works and how it's separate from the political structure as well. And they had the former clerk of the Privy Council, Michael Wernick, actually go in and do one of these show committee hearings that the conservative government loves to do. And Wernick said, those paths didn't cross. There's no path forward, is what he said, to launch a full investigation into an allegation of inappropriate conduct by Vance when it was raised back in 2018. He testified before a parliamentary committee. And I say he was the head of the Privy Council, which runs the PCO, which runs the civil service. And the military is civil service, basically. I mean, it has its own parallel structures, but it is basically run by the civil service. It's not run by the prime minister's office. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens in the Philippines and in banana republics. The president, El Presidente, runs the military. It doesn't work that way in Canada. But it said that the allegation was an informal allegation against the then chief of the defense staff, and put before Harjit Singh before Harjit Sajjan. Okay. And he said, like, unless you got something, again, what can I do with it? The ombudsman of the military had hit a brick wall as well. It didn't go to the PMO. I say, didn't go to Trudeau because it's not Trudeau's business, really. The same way that the Rays, the conservatives love to point to the liberal smoking gun, which is that Vance got a raise of $50,000 a few years back before he retired. And, that's a civil service raise. That isn't, hey, you're doing a great job as the chief of defense staff. Here's $50,000 for your trouble. It's like, no, this is a civil service seniority graded pay raise. That was never you know, if it went to cabinet at all, it would be perfunctory because it was a recommendation of the military talking to the PCO, which then talks to cabinet. And they go like, okay, if, you know, if he's due a raise and this is part of the schedule, then he gets the raise. But the conservatives love to say like, this proves that the liberals love all of these sexual predators because look, they gave him money.
It's, you know, it makes me sad for our politics that it's heading in that direction, that the conservatives are so cynical that they exploit public ignorance for their own benefit, that rather than trying to raise public knowledge of how our system works, they do everything they can to promote ignorance, because ignorance can be molded and shaped, and they throw a lot of dirt in the air, knowing that for many people, where there's smoke, there's fire, and not aware that in politics, as in many things, sometimes where there's smoke, there's an arsonist. And so the conservatives, this is my problem with the conservative party's behavior. See, I don't have a problem with conservative politics. I don't subscribe to them, but I see them as having value in our political system. But it's the tactics of the current party that calls itself conservative that I have a problem with. And those tactics are to promote and exploit ignorance and scream as loud as you can. And it works for some people. For many people, I think they hear about this thing with the military and most people don't give a damn. I think there's probably a collective shrug of shoulders about the military. We're not a militant people. We're not militarized. We're not a martial culture. We don't focus heavily in our social sphere on the military. So I think that this is something that may play to the base of Aaron O'Toole, but I don't think it really plays any bigger than that. What do you think?
No, I don't think it's, you know, I think it only resonates with the people who are looking, you know, who are already sold. I mean, again, that's sort of the core conservatives who believe the worst of the liberal government, you know, just on faith. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are systemic problems in the military. I mean, we've had several commissions and inquiries into harassment and sexism. There's a new one that's being formed and everyone said, oh, here's another one that everyone's just going to shelve all of the recommendations. I was actually kind of pleased that to see that they chairing the new review of the military and sexual harassment in the military is Madam Justice Louise Arbour, who is a former Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. And I've met her a couple of times. She was a really good judge. She went on to be the chief prosecutor at the Bosnian War Crimes mm-hmm. Tribunal, you know, for the World Court. And she's smart. She is really tough. She takes no crap from anybody. You're going to get a really good and really tough report from her, which, you know, which will name names and where the blame is going to lie. I don't think the blame is going to be political, mm-hmm. Because, like I said, they're different silos. The military lives in its own world. You know, politics rarely plays too much of a role in the higher levels of the military. Mm-hmm. So it's going to, you know, it's going to be, you know, it'll be interesting to see where that goes and what happens as a result. But the military is this big monolithic organization. I mean, it suffers from all kinds of institutional problems. I mean, part of it is the recruiting process. I mean, the people who generally are joining the military, you know, certainly not the senior rank levels. I know lots of officers. I know a few enlisted men. There's a certain mindset that leads people into a military career. If you are in more depressed parts of Canada, you know, where there aren't a lot of job opportunities, the military does attract people from there. You know, not quite as much as it does in the United States, where it really mm-hmm. is sort of mm-hmm. a warehousing for poor people and the only opportunity that they're ever going to have for an education.
Yeah.
But in Canada, you know, the people in the enlisted ranks, although do a great job. I'll coach it in any, you know, praise is necessary. They're not necessarily being drawn from the most progressive parts of Canadian society. And so they bring with it a certain macho culture. When they get promoted and put in charge of people, you know, it's a closed system. If, you know, it's been described by some female enlisted people and officers as there is just no recourse for them. So there's no point in complaining. There's no point in doing anything. And we've seen, I think, some good female officers leave because they just couldn't stand the culture. I wonder whether or not that, they put every command position in the military was filled by a woman officer, whether they'd have these problems. I suspect not. I'm sure there are some women officers who, you wouldn't want to spend an afternoon with either, but on the whole, I think you'd see a pretty quick change in culture if they promoted women into not just the traditional public relations and judge advocate general positions into real combat leadership positions, strategic positions. You might see a quick change in culture, but maybe not, because it is persistent. I mean, military culture has been famous for being unenlightened and tough and sexist, mm-hmm. and all those other things for centuries, and it will be one of the last ones to change.
Well, it's not changing. Like, we hear reports on RCMP and the military, and we keep hearing that there are problems and that there's commissions and committees and focus groups and everything trying to fix it, and then another scandal comes to the fore. So what's it going to take to get these things taken seriously? Is it just not in the culture to take it seriously? It just seems like everything's been futile to this point in trying to change anything. Are we expecting too much that these institutions improve when all the trouble comes, when troubling news comes out about them? We expect them to change. Is that too high an expectation, or is it just such an institutional inertia that you can't get anything to change? The problem is just it's permeated too deep.
Part of the problem is just the nature of the beast itself. I mean, the military. You can't have a lot of soft, feelings sensitive people who you turn on other people and kill them. Mm-hmm. It is so antithetical to the culture. I mean, the Canadian military is more peacekeeping and civil emergency, thankfully, than it is, hot war kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, if you have to be called, and I know people who have been sent to Afghanistan as part of the military, and there's no place there for hurt feelings and crybabies and anyone who is anything less than tough and insensitive, because that's the nature of the job.
Right.
It also sort of attracts people who fit in. If you are, if it was me in the military, I think I'd last like 15 minutes, probably not past whatever they served me at lunch, because I'm I'm a bit of a softy. And, you don't want someone who overthinks things. Yeah. If the idea is like, there's a live grenade on the ground, throw yourself on it. I'm looking at it going like, I'm not throwing myself on that.
Are you crazy? How fast can I run the other way?
Let's talk about options here. It's like, no, you want someone who's going to do it without question. And that requires a certain mindset, but it also comes with a lot of other stuff, the hardness and the lack of sensitivity and, not necessarily the most progressive person in the world. When it comes to, dealing with other cultures and sensitivities and the feelings, whether it is, if you're an officer, you don't care too much about the feelings of your subordinates as long as they're doing their job and they obey you. Morale is important, but not as important as obeying orders. And that is what they try to instill in you from the get-go. So to turn them around and say, you know what, you got to worry about your fellow officers, especially in integrated forces, you got to worry about your fellow soldiers' feelings. And, you know, you can't say things that are hurtful. You can't make jokes that are off color. You can't, again, it's so embedded in that culture. I'm not sure how you ever get away from it.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to figure it out here, but the more people talk about the problems, the harder it becomes to sweep them under the rug. So hopefully what we've talked about here will inform people about what the problems are. And sometimes, you know, they can talk and the people they talk to talk. And that's how public opinion crystallizes. There's got to be a critical point at which point the military must change. But we're caught, as you said, between two poles right now. You can't be oversensitive, but at the same time, there are rules to follow. Yeah. And, you know, dignity and honor is part of serving in the military. And certainly Vance, you know, the allegations being true, Vance really didn't serve with dignity and honor. So that ought to be a concern. But yeah,
and women in uniform deserve better. I mean, absolutely. They deserve better. I mean, but you know, how do you get them to that place where they can do their job and not be taken advantage of by men, whether they're senior or same rank?
Well, we're not going to figure it out today, but we open it up for people to think about it and talk about it, which is what we do here on Stephen and Stephen. And it brings us to the close of another podcast. Thank you, Stephen.
Well, thank you.
He is Stephen Lawtons. You can find him on Twitter at Stephen Lawtons, which is StephenLautens. You can't find me on Twitter. You'll find me, but I haven't been there in like a year and a half. So I don't even know what messages are waiting.
You got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, I got bigger fish to fry than my own personal Twitter account.
Arguing with strangers.
Yeah, that is basically what Twitter is.
It is.
Arguing with strangers, being passionately angry at complete strangers. We'll be back again next week. If you have any questions or you have any comments, tweet them to Stephen at Stephen Lawtons. We have a Facebook page. Go there, Stephen and Stephen, and give us your comments. We're always open to hearing your reviews and your thoughts and your questions. So feel free. We're here to help. So Stephen, we'll see you again next week.
I sure hope so.
And I'm Stephen Kersner, and this has been Stephen and Stephen.